minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel, your host here on Stand to Reason. And so glad you joined me today. I sure look forward to talking with you about the most important things we can discuss, ethics, values, and religion. I was talking to somebody a couple of weeks ago at some event somewhere. He said, we never talk about politics or religion, too divisive. I said, politics are the ethical use of power. Religion is ethics, God, and all that. I mean, what could be more important than those two things? So anyway, he's taken the most important things off the table, but we haven't done that here on this show, and that's what we talk about. And it doesn't have to be divisive. This show is called Stand to Reason, which means we try to bring our best thinking to the table and apply it to thinking about the most important things. And you're welcome to join in our conversation at 1-800-227-5278. And if you're in the 714 area code, that's local to me. 754-4150 is the number there. Once again, 1-800-227-5278, and in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Well, it's like 3 weeks and counting, right? 3 weeks and a day until the day, Christmas. And it's time for me to offer my Christmas counsel, my Christmas card counsel that I've been offering the last couple of years. And actually, I'm a little late on this right now. But I need to do this before Thanksgiving next year, and I'm going to try to do that so that you can adapt your conduct to my counsel such as it is. Here's the beef, okay, for me, my concern. Maybe it's a better thing. And I have not, since we moved recently, August, most people are not, many people who would normally send us Christmas cards are not up to speed apparently yet. On our new address, we have to send ours out first to get a lot of people up to speed on that. So we have not gotten a lot of Christmas cards yet, which means I haven't gotten bent out of shape yet. Why would I get bent out of shape about Christmas cards? Because I am absolutely stunned at how many followers of Jesus, people that I know that take their commitment to Jesus Christ seriously, who missed the biggest opportunity all year long to say something productive and fruitful about their relationship with Christ. I mean, these are people that are inclined to share their faith under other circumstances, to talk about their convictions, and hopefully persuade others to think about the claims that Jesus of Nazareth has made on their lives and give consideration to that. So in, you know, all the rest of the year, they're open to that kind of thing. It's built into their lifestyle. These are their convictions, and they believe in, as evangelicals, evangelizing. That's part of their lifestyle. And of course, for most of my friends, there are the standard complaints about the culture moving more and more away from Christ in Christmas, and taking away creches and removing Merry Christmas from the clerk's vocabulary during the Christmas season. And, you know, it's Happy Holidays. And so there are all these complaints. But then when they have the opportunity to put Christ into Christmas in a very, I think, predictable, understanding, and expected way on their Christmas cards, they don't. I don't know about you. If you've been surveying your cards from your friends, do you have committed followers of Christ that send you Happy Holiday cards? Or maybe just a photo and something like that printed on it? Now, I don't think that cards have to always be personalized, but I'm thinking, look, this is the one time of the year where everyone expects us to say something about Jesus. So why don't we? Why is it that when Christmas rolls around, many of you do not use the opportunity to say something worthwhile? And when I say worthwhile, I mean something substantive. You know, when people get cards, even if the cards mention Jesus, the reason for the season, and things like that, their eyes gloss over. They've seen this 1,000 times, wishing you God's blessing and his peace upon you as the Christ child enters your home for this season, or something like that. Well, these are all, yes, they mention Jesus, but they don't mention him in a way that causes anyone to think about what you've just said. I mean, if you're like me, when you get cards, a lot of cards don't say anything significant, whether Christmas cards, birthday cards, whatever. Once in a while, somebody chooses their cards carefully, and then you pause and read something you've never quite heard before, but most of it is peace and blessings on your home and that kind of stuff. And so you don't read it. It doesn't register. It's just, oh, that's that stuff. And you just move on to maybe a note at the bottom or the picture of the kids or that kind of thing. But you don't pay attention to that stuff because it's just Christmas, psychobabble. And so you don't pay any attention to it. So I'm talking about not just saying Jesus is the reason for the season or something along that, or may the Christ child dwell in your heart through faith this Christmas season, but something substantial. I'll tell you the best, most dramatic Christmas card I ever got. And I need to get permission to print this out. It was by a cartoonist friend of ours, who many of you know calls into the show. And it was a rendering that he did quite cleverly of Mary giving birth. And there was a black and white line drawing with one big red splash. You know, like you drop a drop of paint and it hits the paper and splats. It's kind of a splat. And so what was very clever about this, I mean, it was kind of gross, probably. I mean, you couldn't help but notice it. It wasn't little Jesus wrapped in swaddling clothes. It was Mary giving birth to the Savior, because she did. And it was messy, and it was bloody, because he was a real human being, which is the point of the card, and he was born to die. And so this dramatic drawing with the red drop on it, this splatter, really powerfully communicated both the fact of the incarnation and the reason for the incarnation in visual form. That was probably, for me, my money, that's the best. That was great. Everybody who got that, if others got the same one I got from my friend, Doug, I'm sure never forgot it. Now, you don't have to go to that extreme, and maybe you're not clever enough to draw your own drawings or whatever, but can't we do something a little bit more specific? Now, in the past, my wife has actually made our cards, and they've been wonderful. And many of you who've received the cards know this, and many said that they saved them. And so I was the one who usually constructed the inside and wrote something that was meaningful, because it's been so difficult for us to find anything that said anything substantive around Christmas time. We wanted to communicate a message. Indeed, I think one Christmas I took, that was the Christmas of the Passion, you know, the movie, the Passion of the Christ. And that year I had written an article called The Christ of the Passion, what the movie couldn't show. And I talked about what was going on during the 3 hours of darkness that shrouded the cross that on Calvary that Good Friday afternoon when everything went dark. That's the significant time. And the movie couldn't show that. And I talked about the transaction between God and Jesus, God the Father and Jesus, his Son, and what that meant and whatever. And so there's this whole article on it. In fact, you can go to our website at str.org and download it. The Christ of the Passion, what the movie couldn't show. In any event, I took a reduced form of that article, and I captured a couple paragraphs and blended them together to make the point, a rather long point in this case for the purposes of a card, but to make the point about what Christmas was about. And I think that most people could not just gloss over that. They couldn't quick read it. They couldn't say, oh, I know what that's all about. Whatever, ho-hum. But there's a message. In fact, here's what it said. From the cradle to the cross, what the child has done for those who receive his pardon. And I wrote with the verses at the very bottom, Colossians 2:13 and 14 and John 19:30. These are references that I draw from to make this statement. And here's what I wrote. Nailed to the top of Jesus' cross is a certificate of debt to Caesar, a public display of Jesus' crime, King of the Jews. When punishment is complete, Caesar's court will cancel the debt with a single Greek word stamped upon the parchment's face, tetelestai, finished, paid in full. Being king of the Jews is not the crime Jesus pays for, however. Hidden to all but the Father is another certificate nailed to that cross, ours. In the darkness that shrouds Calvary, from the sixth to the ninth hour, God the Father unleashes his fury upon his sinless Son, who has taken upon himself the crimes of the world as if guilty of all. At the last, it was not the cross that takes Jesus' life. When the full payment is made, when the last of the sin debt melts away and the justice of God is fully satisfied, Jesus simply dismisses his spirit with a single Greek word that falls from his lips. Tetelestai. It is finished. And then on the other side of the card, Christmas blessings with a prayer that you come to a quiet place of reflection on the simplicity of Jesus' birth and the magnitude of his purpose. Now, I don't expect everybody to go to that length. In fact, we didn't this year. We got caught up short, and we have a lot of new responsibilities with a new household right now, and so we decided to just buy cards. And I'll tell you, it was slim pickings. We needed 250 of those things, and I was hounding all over town trying to find something that said something substantive. And it was hard. I finally went to a large church there in Thousand Oaks, and they have a big bookstore, and I was able to, you know, cobble together four or five different titles, because there certainly wasn't 15 packets of one kind of card there, to get something that we were marginally satisfied with. And maybe next year we'll do our own thing again in some fashion. I don't know. But my recommendation to you is, if you haven't done anything yet, it might be too late for most of you because you're way ahead of the game and have already sent out your cards. But if you haven't, my exhortation is to do something meaningful with this unbelievable opportunity. Even if all you do is type out on your computer the words of some of the wonderful Christmas hymns that the whole world is singing now. Even atheists, for goodness sake. Jews are singing it. All kinds of religious people of all different stripes in this country largely, and other of the Western nations, even if they don't believe in Jesus, they're singing these songs and ironically proclaiming the glories of God and his incarnate Son during this time. They may not even be thinking about what they're saying, but this is the time they're doing it. And if you just isolate some of those statements from those carols, they are powerful, theologically rich characterizations of what this season is really all about. And what I think we've decided to do in this particular case, I mean, what you may want to do is just buy somebody a card that you like, and this is what the enforcer is doing. Buy a card that you like on the outside that is attractive, and then pasting in kind of your own message. We're going to actually post some of the past messages that my wife and I put together for the inside of our cards, and it'll include the one I just offered. And maybe we can even – can we do the formatting on this, Melinda? Can that go up on the website, or is it just text only? We don't – okay. So you'll just have to grab the text, and you can center it and, you know, format it the way you want so it fits on your card if you want to print these out on your printer and paste them into your card to make a statement. But you're free to use this. Here's another one. Jesus is God's – pardon me. I have a poem by Robert Louis Stevenson in one case. O God, our loving Father, help us – rightfully to remember the birth of Jesus. Actually, it's not a poem. It's just a statement, but it's by Stevenson. That we may share in the song of the angels, the gladness of the shepherds, and the worship of the wise men. May Christmas morning make us happy to be your children, and Christmas evening bring us to our beds with grateful thoughts, forgiving and forgiven, for Jesus' sake. Amen. That's pretty good. It's hard to ignore that one. And we've added on the other side. Usually what we do is we put this created thing, on the left side of the card on the inside, and on the right a smaller thing, like Jesus is God's promise fulfilled. May you take great joy in him and the celebration of his birth. Let's see. Here's another one. Christmas, this is just a short one we put in one year. Christmas is not about giving. You know, you hear all that all the time, right? Christmas is about giving. That's the spirit of giving. It's not about giving. It's about a gift. May the gift of forgiveness through Jesus, our Lord, fill your heart this year. Merry Christmas. Very simple, but it just says a little bit more than you're going to find in most cards. Here's another one. I quote Matthew 1:23, and in where Matthew is actually citing the book of Isaiah, chapter 7. Behold, the virgin shall be with child and shall bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which translated means God with us. And then I write underneath, the God of all creation humbled himself to become a human being, our Savior Christ the Lord. Because Jesus was born, he could die, bringing the abundance of life we enjoy through him. May each of you rest in the security of the babe whose birth we celebrate this day. Again, not particularly profound. It's just an attempt, my attempt, to focus so that when people pick up the card, they don't think on first glance, oh, same old, same old. I don't have to read it. But rather they think, oh, wait a minute, this is different. What is this? Then they read it, and it says something different. And what we're going to do is we're going to post these on our website. It'll probably be posted within the next couple of days on our homepage, str.org. And if you would like to download the text and use them, you are welcome to do so with my blessings. You don't even have to say, like, written by Greg Kokel. I don't care about that in this case. But if you haven't done your cards yet and you want to make a little thing that you paste in or just slip in, you just insert it. It doesn't have to be fancy. A special message to draw people's attention to the, and here's another trite one, reason for the season. Don't ever buy a card that says that anymore, okay? That's like been overworked. You want people's eyes to gloss over, there you go, use that one. But, as a matter of fact, since he is the reason for a season, you give them something else to read to emphasize that. And take your opportunity this one time a year to make a fruitful, meaningful, substantive statement. 1-800-227-5278 is my number. Line's wide open here. And I'd love to have you get in the queue while we're at break in just a moment. If you're in the 714 area code 754-4150, I'm Greg Kokel. The show is, of course, Stand to Reason.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2 and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Ah, yes. It's that time of year again, isn't it?
There it is.
This is actually one of the first Christmas carols I've heard this year. I guess I haven't been shopping enough. Now, I take a perverse delight in the jingle cats here, partly because what I picture is all these cats kind of sitting on a bar with all their tails hanging down, and somebody is jerking these tails, you know, in the proper order to get this get this song. Anyway, that's probably not the way it was done. No animals injured in the making of that song. My pastor said this morning, actually kind of reminds me of what I opened up to talk about here. Oh, by the way, the show is Stand to Reason. Greg Kolkle, your host here, 1-800-227-5278. And in the 714 area code 754-4150, line's almost completely open. You're welcome to call in and chat with me about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. The rule, of course, is give me a piece of your mind. That's it. Back to the pastor and reason for the season kind of stuff. Talked about the woman who was out shopping and just was having a miserable day and couldn't get the present she wanted. And, you know, the last one was sold out and her kid had to have it. And she's going from store to store and she's dropping things and breaking things and slipping on the ice. And it's just a miserable day trying to get all of this Christmas stuff done. And she just barely squeezes into an elevator with her gifts, with a whole elevator full of other people. And it's all so uncomfortable. She's just not liking this at all. And finally, she says to all in the elevator, whoever is responsible for this day should be arrested and strung up and shot. There's some kind of amens and chuckles and whatever, because everybody understood the pressure. And then a moment of silence, and then a small voice in the back said, well, actually, he was crucified. Clever. All right, let's go to Carl in La Mesa, California. Carl, welcome to Stand to Reason. Glad you called.
Okay, well, Greg. I'm graduating with a bachelor's degree in philosophy, and part of what the school wants, in kind of an evaluation, the good parts and what's not so good, what needs to be changed about the philosophy department.
And course, where are you graduating from?
San Diego State.
Oh, okay. Undergrad?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I was, I would like to bring up...
By the way, just so I know, San Diego State, is that... That's like in the Cal State system, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Just because there's a lot of San Diego kind of university types now. UCSD, San Diego State, University of San Diego, stuff. Okay, now I got it.
Okay. It's a secular school, and it's their philosophy department. There's, you know, it's not real, you know, it could be worse, but there's a lot of anti-religious sentiment. There's been some extemporaneous comments by some certain instructors and professors that are very
kind of hostile to the Christian worldview.
If you said that about blacks or sexual orientation, you'd be strung up. You know?
Sure.
And I would like to put in my evaluation something about this. I'm not sure if I should say anything or how I might bring it up. If you had any suggestions.
Well, you might mention that in the interests of balance, that they have more philosophers that are come from a theistic worldview, or who are dualists in terms of the mind body problem. And the reason I mentioned both of these things are hot items. Okay, in the secular world, in the area of philosophy, it's going to be very, very difficult, and I'm sure you've encountered this, of finding anyone who's not a monist with regards to the mind body problem. And what I mean by that, for those outside of this discussion, is that nobody in the field believes in the soul anymore. Uh-huh. It's just it's molecules all the way down, so to speak. That there is no soul. It's just everything can be explained in physicalistic terms of neuroscience and medicine and physics, and that's the end of it, you know. And now there are a lot of reasons why this is the case, in spite of the fact that there are all kinds of problems with this view. But there's no question that you're going to run into that down in San Diego. In fact, at UCSD, which is a cross town school, I guess, from you. Mm-hmm. Because you're San Diego State, that's a different school. But at UCSD, they have some of the most well-known professors there, the Churchlands, promoting this physicalistic view of the human self. So it would be fair, it seems to me, to make the request that there are some people that they have philosophers that come in and lecture on a guest basis that could present the other view and their reasons for it. And there are a lot of people that can do that, firstly from our side of the ledger, but that might be one request. In the interest of academic balance, mm-hmm. you can put it that way. And the same thing about just theism in general. And part of the reason why it's legitimate to mention that, because most of your exposure is not going to be philosophy from the perspective of a biblical theist, but keep in mind that in the history of Western philosophy, since, once Plato and Aristotle and Socrates and that gang was kind of passed, that's mid-third century B.C., after that, virtually every single significant contributor to philosophy and Western – in the history of Western civilization up until about the 18th century was a biblical theist. All the people you're going to read in the history of philosophy – most of them come from a theistic worldview, specifically a biblically theistic worldview, although there's some Muslim philosophers there, and there you got a Quran-based theistic worldview. But how is it then that you have a program where there's no significant exposure to this point of view except for to ridicule it?
There you go.
When it has such not only a significant role in the history of philosophy, but also currently – the number one selling and most widely circulated journal, a philosophical journal in the area of philosophy of religion, is Philosophia Christi from Talbot School of Theology, where I got my MA in philosophy.
Yes, I subscribe to it.
Yeah, well, and this is not a shoddy piece of work, and arguably, and many people on the other side of the aisle have grudgingly acknowledged that it is the Christian theists who are doing the best work right now in the area of philosophy of religion. So I think those are two things that you could mention that should be explored more even-handedly, given the fact that you've got this deep history of Christian theists in the field of philosophy, and you have significant contributions being now made. I mean, look at Alvin Plantinga, for goodness sake. He's one of the best philosophers in the world, and he is a Christian theist. And William Lane Craig is another one. I'm just two right off the top of my head that would be recognized in the field as being significant players on the world stage, uh-huh. And then given that the mind-body problem is so completely dominated now, or discussion about the mind-body problem is so completely dominated by physicalists, uh-huh. that just in the interest of balance and broad education, it'd be good to have someone who could argue the other side. Uh-huh. J.P. Moreland, for example. Who's done a lot of work in that area, has written extensively on it, or even dealing with the naturalism, the kind of thoroughgoing naturalism that is at the heart of the entire philosophic enterprise right now in secular universities. Uh-huh. This is something, by the way, the naturalistic worldview that has been taking hits a lot in the last 15, 20 years. In other words, people have made very legitimate criticisms of these views.
Uh-huh.
And also the postmodern view, which is kind of falling out of favor now in philosophers. But the whole linguistic constructivism that's part of the postmodern project, which has been part of the main dialogue among philosophers for the last 20 or 30 years, now is falling out of favor. But there's been very good critiques of that coming from the right-hand side of the kind of political spectrum, so to speak. Philosophical political spectrum. So these are the kinds of things that I would mention if I were you.
Okay.
Sound good?
Yeah, sounds good. Thanks, Greg.
Yeah, okay. I appreciate your call. 1-800-227-5278. And for a moment, I thought maybe our phones weren't working because we got a very slow day today, which is highly unusual. But is there a, like, this isn't a Super Bowl, is it? NBA playoffs? March Madness? What's going on? Nothing? Christmas shopping, huh? Well, I hope if they're out there shopping, they're getting good Christmas cards that say something meaningful. 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Lines wide open here. I mentioned a few moments ago about postmodernism, and of course, as a follower of Jesus Christ, it's something that I'm very concerned about. We have I've been writing a series of articles now. Third one coming out January 1st, in which I'm trying to bring our constituency, which is many of you, up to speed on an understanding of the emerging culture, which is deeply influenced by postmodernism, and the emerging church, which is also deeply influenced by postmodernism, generally speaking. Now, when I say emerging church, I'm using the small e, small c, and I'm understanding. And I understand that this is a very, very broad movement, and there are lots of different ideas here. I think what gives the emerging church its legs or its distinction is that these are the Christians that are emerging out of an old culture, one that I was more comfortable with, the old-timers, you know, more of a modernistic point of view and the way of looking at the world. And they are sympathetic to the fact that the field has changed dramatically in the last 20 or 30 years, and things are just, you know, it's just a new world out there, and people think differently now, and so therefore there's got to be a new way to reach these people. Not necessarily that we have to change our message, but we sure have to be careful that we are contextualizing the message that we have received once and for all delivered to the saints and communicating it in a way that this new generation can sink their teeth into, can understand in light of its new way of thinking and talking. And that's a task that every generation has to face. The controversy has come about with exactly how we do that. And when do we cross the line from being appropriately contextualizing of our message in the culture to actually adopting the culture's way of looking at things? And this is, to me, the divide. It is the divide that matters in the emerging church. There's a lot of differences, but this is the difference I care about. When you go from being missional, that is, having a heart to reach an emerging culture and to be sensitive as a missionary to this cross-cultural enterprise, to being enamored with their ideas to the point where you're taken captive by the philosophy and empty deception according to the traditions of men instead of according to Christ. And here you can tell I'm paraphrasing Paul from Colossians 3. And that's my concern. Now, we have always been, on this show, been very careful, I think, to distinguish point out that the field is divided on this in the emerging church, and that some are on one side of that and some are on the other. Some are, if in a sense, orthodox. They understand the importance of truth classically characterized, and they understand importance of theology classically characterized, and they cling to this. But everything else can go. That is, all the other trappings are negotiable. Becoming all things to all men in order that by all means I might win some. That's one side of the spectrum. On the other side is everything's negotiable. Not just the way we communicate, not just the forms, but also the theology and also our understanding of truth. And that scares me. It doesn't scare me for myself. It scares me for the church. And this is why we've tried to maintain conversations with people on both sides of the aisle. And so those who we think are being wooed over by a more postmodern view of the world and are compromising in ways that are troubling would be more the emergent village types, the Brian McLarens, the Doug Padgetts, the Tony Joneses at all, those following their lead. And so we've been, though engaged in conversation with them, I think we have been critical I think in a charitable way, by and large, but we have been raised questions about their ideas and the directions that they're going. But on the other hand, we have tried to build bridges with those that we think are doing a good job in clinging to what is sound and at the same time trying to be missional in appropriate sense to this emerging culture. And so we're making common cause with them. One of those people is Dan Kimball, who was really one of the founding voices, if I can say it that way, of the emerging church movement. And he is one of those guys that is deeply concerned about the impact that the church is having in the culture, or I guess should say is not having for good, but is having having for ill, and wants to correct that situation. And I'm just reading a new book of his. They Like Jesus, But Not the Church. It's not out yet, but it will be. And I really like what I read. Maybe in a bit I'll tell you more about it. I want to go up to the phones right now and talk with Jason in Laguna Niguel. Let me find the button. There you go, Jason. Welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hey, Greg. How you doing?
Doing okay, buddy.
I enjoy your work. Thanks for all you do.
Thank you.
Quick question. I'm in the field of music, and I have kind of a little problem with one of the things that happens in my church sometimes. I'm not the leader of my church, but mm-hmm. I sing sometimes. And it's the tactic of taking a secular song and changing the words to be about Christ, mm-hmm. about God. So I wonder if you have any thoughts on that. I have a problem with it. I think there's a connotation with a song, especially if it's a song most people know from outside the church, and then just switching the words to Jesus' words, I don't think wipes out the connotation. Do you have any thoughts mm-hmm. on that?
Well, yeah, I do. Do you know, ever heard of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony? I mean, not heard of it, but do you know what that sounds like?
Yes, very well.
Now, that is the choral part, and it's sung in German. I don't actually know what the words are in German, but I know a song to that tune. Joyful, joyful, da 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 da, Christ adore thee, something like that, okay? Now, my suspicion is, and I could be wrong about this, my suspicion is that that isn't the German translation of the words that Beethoven wrote.
No, the German, Beethoven was a humanist. The German words are more about the nobility of man.
Okay. Okay, good.
Achievements.
Okay, good. So here is a song that many Christians have sung to Beethoven's tune. Mm-hmm. And the tune, if what you say is correct, I don't know that it is, but we'll just grant that it is for the sake of discussion, is that this was written as a paean to humanism of some sort, and now it's been captured by Christians and invested with new significance. Then I think there's an I don't know that if we think of that music, anybody would have any problem with the fact that they did that. Now, you might want to say, well, that's because people nowadays don't know the meaning of the tune back then to the ears of the original listeners, and they only know it in this other sense. And maybe that has some legitimacy to it. But what I'm trying to sketch out for you is just a broad guideline.
Sure.
I am not going to be offended because some secular music is used to convey Christian terms. I'm not going to be offended by the act itself. I'm trying to think of another. You know, the battle hymn of the...
Can I comment on your example? Because I think it's a distinction, maybe.
Well, and that may be a relevant distinction, but and I'll hear it in just a second. But my point is simply that simply taking the secular tune and reinvesting it with Christian language is not troublesome to me. Now, it may be faulted on other grounds, and maybe that's what you have in mind. But just doing that isn't troubling to me at all.
I guess with the Beethoven, that was actually kind of a folk song he took, and he made the words up to it. But the text is kind of, in a way, noble and somewhat innocuous. I'm talking about like a popular song that's about kind of illicit activities, or the song I'm thinking of is an Eagle song. It's about kind of a tryst in the desert, about having sex with a woman, and the words have been...
Is that like a horse with no name? Is
no,
it
it's different than that, but...
Is that an Eagle song?
I don't think so.
I'm displaying my musical ignorance. My wife is probably cringing.
Well, we just changed the words in our church to Amazing Grace instead of the words about having sex in the desert. And we sing Amazing Grace instead. And I know for me, who I know that song because of growing up having heard it,
yeah,
it's a very familiar tune to most people in my generation. I hear the song with the words.
I know, right, right, right.
I'm
okay.
Trying to worship God, and what I have going through my head is a song about a sexual relationship.
Gotcha. I gotcha.
Relationship.
Jason, hold on just a minute. I got to go to break. I'll come back and answer your question. Greg Kokel, okay. Stand to Reason, coming back with more. Stay with us.
It is a rare opportunity to study under some of the finest minds in the field of Christian thought. We have collected a world-class team of Christian thinkers to give you the tools and skills you need to confidently defend the faith and to guard the treasure that has been entrusted to you as a follower of Christ. Our 2006 Master Series of Christian Thought set of lectures includes 5 excellent Christian teachers addressing timely topics to help you understand and address timely issues confronting Christian ambassadors. You can find out more about this unique training resource at our website, str.org, or call our office at 1-800-2-REASON. Learn from some of the sharpest minds in Christianity today. You'll be challenged and encouraged. The 2006 Master Series and Christian Thought Series is available at str.org.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to his disciple Timothy and encouraging him to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul also exhorted him to guard the treasure. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman whose job it is to protect those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that has been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. Stand to Reason has chosen it as our theme this year because it reflects the heartbeat of our ministry. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we are training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at www.str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful training materials to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's www.str.org.
Okay. Greg Kokel back with you on Stand to Reason. Now, I can't exactly picture the dogs perched upon that rod there. It's not quite the same. Let's see. Coming up, Master Series of Christian Thought every January. Of course, we have 5 to 10 weeks of speakers on Monday nights starting early January. And this particular series, following our theme this year of Expanding Horizons, starts January 8th and it goes to February 5th. Of course, it'll be at Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach, where it has been for the last umpteen years. And kicking off with Dr. J.P. Moreland, and his topic, The Lost Virtue of Happiness. The enforcer's on the phone right now, but I suspect we'll probably have him on the show. Well, we've already talked to him about this issue, so it was a great interview. But his new book, The Lost Virtue of Happiness, he kicks off on January 9th, and Jennifer Roback Morris is going to be talking about how science has shown the Bible is right about marriage and sex. Then James Emery White, A Mind for God, after his new book by the same title. Alan Schliemann from Stand to Reason will be talking about decoding Islam, understanding the Middle East conflict in a whole new light. And then finally, I'll be talking about the intolerance of tolerance, February 5th, and closing off the series. So mark your calendars early, all right, starting January 9th, Monday night, 7 o'clock, and continuing to February 5th. The Master Series of Christian Thought. Also, you may want to head out to Biola University this Thursday, December 7th, because there's a huge enterprise, and my apologies for not talking about it last week. It's called The Case for a Creator, and it is a whole new seminar dealing with that. The title, of course, following Lee Strobel's best-selling book, and Lee Strobel will be there, Craig Hazen, J. Wesley Richards, J.P. Moreland, and John Bloom. Also a feature. Oh, I see this. I guess I'm not sure what to. Is this? Are they all going to be there lecturing, or are they just going to show the movie? I know there is a movie for this. Do you know what this is? They're lecturing? Okay. Anyway, go to apologeticsevents.com, and there's more detail there. 7:30 to 9:30 this Thursday, December 7th at the Biola University Chase Gymnasium. And my congratulations to Richard Cowan from Macclesfield, England, who is our Frapper winner for this week. And by the way, if you're listening, Richard, we do not have a current address or a current email for you, so we tried to contact you. So you'll have to contact us to get your free gift. Of course, Richard Cowan from Macclesfield, England, has been registered on our map of listeners. If you go to our website at str.org, in the lower left-hand corner, hit the radio button. Or is it the podcast button? The podcast button. And then you'll see a map come up where you can plug your flag in, plant your flag, and show that where you live and that you're a listener. And from that group of people on the Frapper map who have planted their flags, we draw every week to give a free gift away. And Richard Cowan of Macclesfield, England, is today's winner. All right, back to Jason in Laguna Niguel. And I've been thinking about this a little bit, Jason, and you raise a very, very good point about, gee, what are the guidelines when we take a secular song and kind of put new lyrics to it? Where we cross the line? And I started out by saying, and it sounds like you're on board with me, that in principle the act itself is not necessarily questionable, but sometimes right. Individual examples of that may be. And in your case, you're
I agree with that. I agree.
Okay. So, and I guess my response is that you have to take it on a case-by-case basis. The song that, I don't know what it is that you described by the Eagles, you know, I'm not too clever, and that must be
song, like, it's called A Peaceful, Easy Feeling.
Oh, that one.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess I never listened to the lyrics enough to know that this is really about a sexual encounter, but maybe it is. And so if that's obvious to everybody who has listened to it in the past, and now it's the same song but with Amazing Grace attached to it, that doesn't even sound like a very clever coupling, those words to that music, to me, you know. but in any event, if you end up thinking about the original meaning, I think that that's kind of defeats the purpose, doesn't it?
Perhaps, yes.
So, I mean, I guess I'd be with you on a case-by-case basis when there are songs that just seem to be over the top and you can't escape their original meaning, even though you've done some new things with the lyrics. But as far as the practice itself, I'm not against it in general. It just depends individually what it sounds like.
Some discretion needs to be used. That's all.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, you might say something to your pastor. I don't know. If this kind of thing happens a lot and they make poor choices a lot, you might mention something to them. But you want to be careful that you're not always, you know, people are trying different things to be good. And feedback is sometimes helpful if it's charitably given. But, you know, they're trying hard, then they get beat up by a bunch of people. And, you know, then it doesn't help anything. So you just might want to think about that.
Well, I appreciate it.
Okay, Jason, I appreciate
it. One thing to all your listeners, go to that Creator seminar thing. They came and did that at my church, Lee Strobel and Jonathan Wells and that group, and it was outstanding.
Yeah, did they lecture or did they show the movie or a combination of both?
A combination. We had Moreland and Jonathan Wells and the guy who wrote Privileged Planet. And,
yeah, that's J. Wesley Richards.
Strobel. Right. It was excellent. Lots of good dialogue and a lot of good ideas.
Well, you did a better promo for it than I did.
Well, my pleasure.
Thanks, Jason. All right, good to talk to you. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee, and make that Kevin. Welcome to Stand to Reason, Kev.
Thanks, Greg. I just had a question regarding a Kierkegaard book that I just read.
Okay.
It's Works of Love, and I'm not sure if you've read it or not.
I have never read anything by Soren Kierkegaard, as it turns out. I've never had occasion to. I know just a little bit about his philosophy. He's the leap of faith guy, actually. And I think what he was trying to do is restore, you know, he was trying to reverse the trend away from the church, and he adopted kind of a leap of faith mentality that was meant to try to bring people back into the church, given the fact that there was this great incursions by higher criticism and liberal theology that was ruining people's faith. So he kind of, if I understand correctly, and I don't want to misrepresent his views, but he offered, you know, that it turns out that faith is a leap anyway, so it doesn't matter what these other guys are saying. You can still have a vibrant Christian faith even though, you know, the facts aren't going in our direction, I guess, something along that line.
Right.
Now, I think this is a big mistake if that's his view, but that's pretty much all I know about him. Although he did love the Lord, from what I can tell, like a lot of people, he made a mistake that did us no favors.
Right. And the book that I read was more of a, it's called Works of Love.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is about his various descriptions and conditions of love.
Mm-hmm.
When reading the book, I was filled with warmth and love and hope, and just because it's beautifully written.
Mm-hmm.
But I realized how short I fall every day in life
with right.
the love that I show towards my neighbors. It's almost more of an etiquette instead of a love.
You mean what you have is more of an etiquette than the kind of love that Kierkegaard described? Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Okay.
Are
you saying because you don't have a kind of an emotional component to the love that you're showing other people? You're being kind to them, but it doesn't have an emotional component, and so you feel it falls short in that regard.
I think so. And his the whole theme throughout the book is love that you have with your spouse and family versus love you have with your neighbor, as where the former contains no ethical task. And that we show preferential treatment. And this could sound like a stupid question, but worded correctly, I think it's very relevant. That we have something to gain as individuals through personal relationships, like with our spouse and siblings and things of that nature, whereas love towards neighbors is truly, doesn't expect anything in return.
Okay, let me just comment on that so far. I'm troubled by that characterization, though I understand the point that he's making. First of all, love towards your family and your spouse, your kids, does contain an ethical element. There are directives in the scriptures regarding how we treat family members, wives, children, etc. I was just reading in 1 Peter the other day about the interaction, for example.
1 Peter
chapter 2 or 3, right in there. I mean, I'm just as an example, but there are other passages as well. Ephesians chapter 5 has some. And other passages, I mean, certainly there are ethical obligations that we have. Now, it might be to Kierkegaard, if you get something in return, then it is not truly ethically noble.
Right.
But that's based on a certain understanding of ethics. Maybe a duty perspective that Immanuel Kant was big on. It's called deontological ethics. And it has influenced a lot of us. Notice how we say, well, thank you for doing that. You say, oh, no, it was nothing. And
right.
we think it wasn't really a good thing for us to do that because it didn't go against our nature. It wasn't hard for us to do. It was easy, so you can't give me credit for it. I mean, we implicitly, that's kind of what we're saying. But that reflects this idea that it's only noble if you do it when you don't want to do it, but you do it anyway. And so it was really hard for you to do it, but you did it, and so you fulfilled your duty and got nothing in return. You know, there is another perspective, though. I mean, think of Jesus. Do you think Jesus enjoyed doing good?
I definitely do.
Of course. So every time he did something good to somebody, he enjoyed it. Now, was it hard for him to do? No, if you're perfectly holy, it isn't hard.
Right.
But that's not a vice. It's a virtue. It's
right.
a virtue that you are so in tune with goodness that you love to do that which is right to do. And
right.
And by the way, that's a different perspective on morality called virtue ethics. The best kind of person is not the person who does it out of duty with no desire to, and so it's a lot of hard work, but the person who does it because he loves doing it. That's a better kind of person, and that's the kind of person Jesus was. So I'm pointing out that this assessment is based on a certain understanding about how the ethical project works that, I don't think is entirely sound. I think there are times when we do things out of duty, and we should do them, even if it's hard for us to do. But the best situation is when we are developed enough in ourselves that it's not difficult, but our character is such that it's easy to do what's right. And I think that's the way Jesus was, and I think that's the kind of people that would be the highest form of morality,
right.
I think, biblically speaking. So I think – so this is where I think it sounds to me like Kierkegaard misses a bit. It should be satisfying to help other people. I mean, I could say, if you don't mind me using myself as an example, my wife and I give financially. And there are times to me, I enjoy giving because I get something from that. I feel good about taking the things that I've earned and helping someone else with that. And I don't think that's a shortcoming of my ethical contribution here. I think it's a good thing when it's like that.
Right. And just what you're talking about now is a little bit different than the way he approaches it, because his is a duty. It's based on duty, and a lot of the...
Oh, we lost you there. Just, Kevin, I'm sorry. We ran out of time here. But thank you for the call, and you're right. It is based on duty from that perspective, and that may be a place to start, but it's not the place to end. All right? We want to go beyond that. Okay, Kev, thanks for the call.
All right, thanks.
All right, hour number two just ahead, 1-800-227-5278. Lines open there, and in the 714 area code, 754-4150. I'm Greg Kokel. Stay tuned.
Question.
yeah. Are those turkeys or, I thought we were rooster boosters here. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason, hour number two. Thank you for joining me here in our second hour, and I'd love to talk with you. 1-800-227-5278. There it is. In the 714 area code, 754-4150. Give me a piece of your mind. That's the only rule here, and I will give you a piece of mind. My commitment is to give you something worth thinking about every weekend, Sundays 3 until 5, usually. Now, for the next couple of weeks until the end of the year, we'll be going off the air about 4:45 because just the way the station works here at KBRT, my flagship station for the last 17 years, just finishing up our 17th year, right? And mid-February starting 18. But they're on until sundown, and so since that's earlier in December here in Southern Cal, for the next couple of weeks we'll be closing out at 4:45. But then first of the year we'll be back to our two-hour show. Let's go right back to the phones because we've got a lot of folks on board here. And this is Chris in Wilmington, California. Chris, welcome to Stand to Reason. Hi.
Hi. I was reading something by Harold Bloom. It's like half a page. I'll try to read it real quick.
Well, no, don't read a half a page to me by Harold Bloom. Why don't you just summarize the point? And
he.
Thank you.
Says, I heard that Jesus spoke in Aramaic.
Yeah, that is probably the case.
Okay, he says all the oldest veritable text of the New Testament are in Greek.
Yes, that's true.
So he says, if you think Jesus was God, don't you think there'd be some text, something written down somewhere of the actual Aramaic of what Jesus said? Then he said Aramaic and Greek are very different languages.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, I'm not sure what the point is.
So when he says he confronts Christians with this, he gets sort of a blank stare.
Okay, well, let me just backtrack for a second here, Chris. If you think Jesus was God, don't you think there'd be something written in Aramaic? I don't get that. I don't see how one follows from the other.
Well,
why is the fact that... pardon me?
If he spoke in Aramaic, and that means everyone else around there was fluent in it, too.
Yes. Okay, I admit that. I just don't get the connection. He seems to think this is somehow a flaw in our view of things and the idea that Jesus was God because there's no Aramaic texts around. I don't understand the rationale. How does the fact that he spoke in Aramaic but we have Greek texts somehow indicate – it flies in the face of our doctrine that Jesus is God? I don't get that.
Well, when you said Aramaic and Greek are very different languages, and...
Just like English and Greek are different languages, right. Aramaic is more like Hebrew, I think. Although I don't speak it and I don't know much about it, but I think it's...
You have such a high opinion of this person, Jesus, that you think he's God. Wouldn't there some effort have been made? I mean, he said unless there's some sort of, like the Dead Sea Scroll, some sort of Aramaic text of what Jesus said that predates all the Greek translations.
Okay, I still don't understand the significance of that because he's God. Are you saying if he's really God?
Look on the Gospel of Thomas.
Pardon me?
He thinks it's superior to.
Well, that's a different discussion. It would have to be superior because you trusted the author of the Gospel of Thomas to get it right better than the authors of the canonical Gospels. And that's a separate discussion, and I don't actually see any good reason to believe that particular point. Is the Gospel of Thomas written in Aramaic? I don't think it is.
I think it's
Greek. Pardon me?
I think it's in Coptic.
No, the original is in Greek. The copy we have right now is 4th century, and it is Coptic from a Greek translation. So I don't know why see, now you've got Aramaic to Greek to Coptic. So, I mean, I don't know why he's more satisfied with that. It's from the Nag Hammadi Library that's found in 1947 or thereabouts. And there are some people who think that Thomas is more reliable. I don't know why. It's not really an accounting of Jesus' life. It is just a listing of 123 sayings or something of Jesus. And some of them are really weird, and some of them are exactly like canonical texts. But
there's just one sentence. If you believed in the divinity of Jesus, would you not wish to have preserved the actual Aramaic sentences he spoke, since they were for you the words of God?
No, because that isn't that isn't my doctrine of the word of God. That doesn't hold my doctrine. In that sense, he would have, every one of his words would have been the words of God. There's no question about that. But
that's a good question.
If he's asking me what I would have preferred,
yeah.
I would say, okay, I prefer that. Now what? Since I don't get what I prefer, then what follows from his observation for the deity of Christ or theology in general? My point is, nothing follows from that. You can't conclude, gee, we don't have the original Aramaic, and therefore the Bible's not reliable? Therefore, Jesus isn't God?
He says that Greek and Aramaic are so different, such different.
But so is French and English, but it doesn't mean that Frenchmen can't speak and have their French words translated into English, for goodness sake, you know? I don't understand why. I just don't see the line of his thinking, the logic.
The nuances of spirituality and wisdom do not translate readily from Aramaic into Greek. Any sayings that Jesus opened or hidden need to be regarded in this context.
Do you think that the disciples, when they translated Greek, they had kind of like a Memorex recording in their head, and they were translating from that recording? Do you think if they would have written down in Aramaic, they would have transcribed Jesus' lectures in Aramaic? Do you think that's what? No, they wouldn't have done that, because nobody does that. Nobody does that, especially from the ancient period. What they do is they summarize. They summarize what he said, and sometimes he said it in different words because it looks like he gave the same talk in different places and used a little different language each time. Anyway, the point is that he thinks that it is somehow an argument, or maybe you do too, maybe you're persuaded by this, but the point is that there is somehow the deity of Christ and the testimony of Christians is compromised because we don't have the original language that Jesus spoke in.
Yeah, I think that's what Bloom's saying.
Yeah, okay. Well, thanks for the clarification. But I don't see how our doctrines are compromised at all. If it's possible to summarize somebody else's points of view accurately using a different language that one is familiar with, then we have no difficulty whatsoever. And anyway, my doctrine of inspiration...
Summarized, then.
Pardon me?
How do you know they're properly summarized?
Well, see, this goes
original Aramaic.
Yes, if this goes though to the doctrine of inspiration, and if someone is going to attack the Christian position has to attack the Christian position. All right, the Christian position is that the words written in the autographs, that is the original epistles and gospels, were the words inspired by God. The Christian position is not simply those exact words uttered by Jesus were inspired by God. If the disciples summed up Jesus' saying, our doctrine says that their summaries are also the very words of God.
Yeah.
But they're in a different sense than Jesus uttering those words. So we're not compromised by using a different, according to our doctrine, we're not compromised by using a different language to express the teachings of Jesus, because our doctrine is that God so secured or so involved himself in the writings of the originals, even in the Greek, that they wrote down, those writers, exactly what God intended, such that it could be called the very theonoustos, or the breathing of God himself, the very breath of God, if you will. So that's our doctrine. Now, our doctrine might not be sustainable. That's a different question. But he is jousting at phantoms here, because he is not attacking the view we hold. Our view is that the Greek is the word of God, not just the Aramaic spoken by Jesus. The Greek is also the word of God.
Okay.
And that's, do you see the point there?
Yes.
It's quite different, all right? By the way, there's a reason why it's in Greek. Do you speak Aramaic?
No.
Okay. Do you know many people who speak Aramaic?
No.
There's not many people who do, and there wasn't back then either. The people right around Jesus did, but this isn't a gospel just for the Jews or for those living in Palestine at that time, is it?
No.
It's a gospel for what? The whole world. Mm-hmm. And so what God did is he arranged, working through those writers, to have the message written in the coin of the realm, basically. Koine Greek. The trade language, if you will. It's what everybody did business in. And it wasn't the Attic Greek, the High Greek of the Iliad and the Odyssey or something like that, you know. It was rather the Greek of the common person. So it was an accessible language that they used. And what they did is they chose the language to communicate this message for everyone in the language that most everyone would understand. It's just that simple. And the doctrine is that God worked in such a way as to secure the truthfulness of those things they wrote, even though it wasn't in the same words, the same language of Jesus.
All right.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. I appreciate the call. Maybe I gave too much information on that one. Just a thought, by the way, there is a tradition in the early church that Matthew originally wrote his gospel in the Hebrew dialect. And I would take that to be Aramaic. Now, that is contested, and no one's ever produced an Aramaic copy of the Gospel of Matthew, but there is that testimony in the tradition. You read the writings of the early church fathers, and there's this reference. So, okay, let's go to Holland, Michigan. And Pat, welcome to Massachusetts. Sorry, Pat.
That's all right.
I think that's MA, right?
Just exchanging one podunk entity for another, that's all.
Well, Holland isn't exactly podunk in Michigan. I mean, this is where those Dutch Reform folks are at, and they got big Ferris wheels there. But anyway, Pat, good to have you in from Massachusetts.
Thanks. It's not a safe place always to be.
Well, you're not saying Pachtika and the Odd kind of thing, so I can understand you at least.
No, I just don't carry that. I just don't carry that Kennedy accent.
Okay, good. All right.
I want to definitely be differentiated in a number of ways.
All right, Pat.
All right. Anyway, I was thinking as I was doing some studying of Islam and Mormonism that, you know, that it seems to me that God, my initial comment to, I don't know if it was Melinda, was that God would have to be necessarily Trinitarian. But I should be a little more specific. I think God, as the greatest possible being, would have to be necessarily relational. And he would therefore have to be that from all eternity.
Mm-hmm.
So God would have to be more than one person, because we know as human beings that we are essentially relational. I don't, at least of those major monotheistic and even the Mormon religion that understand the priority relationship in our human
mm-hmm.
affairs.
Right.
I think, you know, God could not be, he would have to have learned. Relationship to me is something that has to be experienced in order to be at all. You can't know relationship in the abstract in an unexperienced way.
That's right. There is an abstract understanding about relationship, but that's not the same as being in relationship.
Right.
Now, why would God have to be in relationship? I'm looking when a person says, and let me bring the rest of the audience up to speed on this. When somebody says that a thing is a necessary characteristic. What they mean by that is that when you think of the thing, when you reflect on the thing in question, you realize that it must be the way it is, have this necessary characteristic, and it's impossible for it to have been differently. That's what it means for necessary. It must be this way, and it could never have been different, okay? So if we say if God exists of necessity, it can't be any other way than that he must have multiple persons, maybe not three, but at least two, because you have to have persons in order to have genuine relationship. So and you must think that relationship is a necessary, something about the capability of relationship or the actuality of relationship is a necessary quality of God, and therefore there's got to be another person. I'm trying to figure out how you put this together.
I think that it's required by his omniscience. And I think it's, if it was something that God would have to learn only after he created human beings, then that would seem to indicate a change.
I got you. Okay, well, let me ask you a question. This requires a clarification here on the notion of omniscience then, because classically put, and I'm going to try to put it as precisely as possible, that omniscience holds that God knows and believes all true propositions. It doesn't mean that he experiences, in that sense of knowledge, everything that can be experienced. I mean, there are three different ways that the word knowledge is used. You have know that. That would be knowledge of proposition. You have know who. That would be relationship. And you have know how. That would be skill or capability. And all three, I think, are involved in being a Christian. But omniscience only deals with the first thing. And here's why it would have to be the
–
and let me tell you why that has to be the case. If you say that for omniscience requires all the – not only know that, but all the relational affective knowledge as well – in addition to the know-how, then not only would God have to know relationship while he's in relationship, he would also have to know guilt by being guilty. And I don't think either of us want to say that God knows guilt by being guilty, because he's not guilty in the sense of having moral failings of any at all. But certainly knowledge of guilt in that sense is a very unique kind of thing.
I don't think you have to know privation in order for privation to be privation, and I would think guilt is privation of some sort.
No, I'm saying guilt is culpability, responsibility for wrongdoing with the punishment that hangs over your head as a result of it. So I think evil is a privation, but I don't think guilt is privation. And so that's why I chose that one, because I didn't think it fell victim to that kind of...
Perhaps that's a wrong designation, a wrong attribute to designate that too, but I'm trying to put together in my mind, when I first thought of it, I kind of got this kind of intellectual sense that it tasted good.
Yeah, of course. Well, that's a good place to start, no question. Yeah. And I don't fault you for your attempts here. I'm just – the line of reasoning you're – I'm sorry.
The greatest possible being, I just think ontologically God would have to be relational in order to be able to create something that he could be relational with. For example, when we say God is love, God didn't become love.
Well,
without other things, God couldn't possibly love.
Well, now you're I think, on more solid ground. You don't have to be relational to create something you can be in relation with, you know. But I don't think that's going to go through. But if God is love, isn't love the kind of thing that is shared? And if God is love, but he has love that is not shared, then what kind of love is that? It seems like love itself is relational, and therefore there needs to be multiple persons in the eternal Godhead to be sharing love for God truly to be said to be a God of love. Now, that I think you're on much more solid ground, and others have argued that way themselves. In fact, Gary Deweese, a philosopher friend of ours, has also argued that because of this, God must also be temporal for eternity, because relationship and love between the persons of the Trinity is a temporal dynamic kind of thing, and it can't be timeless. So, I mean, my congratulations that you're trying to do some fruitful, productive thinking on this rather esoteric issue, but good for you. And I think your second attempt here, your second suggestion, your second strategy is going to be more fruitful than your first. But
That would limit us to people that accept the Bible as even semi-authoritative in a sense, because I think outside of those texts, of people that accept them, you have a difficult time making the God is love argument.
Well, yeah, I don't know if that's going to be the case, partly because we do have a text that says that in 1 John chapter 4. But a person who's going to argue based on necessity could argue that love is a necessary characteristic of God if he does exist, and then you can go through with that, and others have tried to do that. So just in a purely philosophic reflection, if love is an excellence, and God perfectly embodies all excellences,
Yes.
Okay, then love would be a necessary characteristic of God, and you don't need a Bible to say that. It just turns out that the Bible says what you'd about God, what you'd expect God to be like if you reflected on him carefully. All righty?
Good.
Got to run. Appreciate the yes, Pat. Appreciate the call from Holland, Massachusetts. Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason. I'll be back in just a moment.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2 and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
You know, there's just something about Christmas carols, right? They just never grow old. I mean, if you listen to them for all year long, they would, but it's just they're so rich, especially the older ones, right? I love to hear those things and looking forward to the next few weeks in our own home as we play many, many of those. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason, and back to the phones real quickly. I actually went over time on the last one, so I need to tighten it up here. Roberta, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, thanks for letting me be on.
You're welcome. I think you're the first lady for today.
Well, actually, I my husband is a great fan of yours, and so kind of whether I want to or not, we often listen to you.
All right. Well, thanks to your husband.
That's true. And I was actually decorating the tree earlier in your show, and you had the caller that called in and said, I don't like it when people sing secular songs in church. I don't And I'm like, oh, man, I got to call in for that one.
Good. What's on your mind, Roberta?
Well, I just wanted to say that I sing at my church, and I have I sung secular songs with the words slightly changed and had a tremendously positive impact on
me. For
example, there's a Van Morrison song that Rod Stewart recorded several years ago called Have I Told You Lately That I Love You?
Oh, okay.
And the word, hardly with any changes at all, the words are very, very Christian. Have I told you lately that I love you?
In other words, you could read it. It reminds me of You Light Up My Life, you know, Debbie Boone, and it was a secular song, and you could kind of read into it, deconstruct it, if you will, however you wanted to. Although there was one questionable line in there, how could it be wrong when it feels so right? I wasn't thrilled with that particular, because obviously lots of things that feel right could be wrong. But for the most part, this is an example of a song, and it sounds like the one you're describing, that could be kind of read different ways with the same lyrics, depending on who's singing it.
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
I think what's significant is that when songs are sung that are not common. So, you get a secular song in a Christian church, it may cause people in the congregation to go, wait a minute, that's a secular song, but hey, are those words right? And they'll actually, I think, consider the words more than they would have if it was just a traditional Christian song.
Roberta, what about the circumstance the gentleman was talking about? That here is a song from the Eagles or whatever, Peaceful, Easy Feeling, that I didn't know this, but apparently it's about a sexual encounter, and he just couldn't get that out of his mind, even though he's singing, you know, Amazing Grace to this old tune. Do you think that falls in a different category?
I do, and actually we do Alpha in our home as well, and that's actually one of the songs that we sing, and it's actually a really good song because most people who are not Christian that come to Alpha are more familiar with that.
But you sing Peaceful, Easy Feeling?
Yeah, it goes, of course, I'm not going to think of it now that I'm on the radio.
But, okay, so in other words, there are phrases that you could understand and interpret in light of some Christian thing. But there, in the Alpha, that's somewhat of an outreach, as I understand it,
right,
introducing people to the basics of Christianity. And so, you know, I think that's going to be a little different situation because you want to sing music that's nice and not too bad, but is familiar to the people that are there for the first time and may feel maybe a little out of sorts there or whatever.
That is correct.
Out of place.
Well, we've sung that at church as well.
Huh. So that doesn't trouble you then, that one?
To his point, they said, I just can't get that out of my mind, and I respect that and I understand. But I would liken that to if somebody had been involved, and I'm not familiar with it, but let's say someone had been involved in a Satan worship thing and they had candles in that service, and then they came to a Christian church and saw candles in that service, and you were
right,
like, well, I don't have candles because that just reminds
right
me.
Well, somebody could argue that that's in itself rather benign, but in the case of the song, you don't have a benign, I mean, I don't remember the lyrics, but let's just say he's right about this. That
the lyrics are actually, Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I...
Well, I understand. The lyrics, I know, from The Amazing Grace, it's the music that kind of conjured that up. But, you know, I don't have a yes or no answer to that. I just think it's, as I mentioned to him, it's a case-by-case basis, and you have to look at it. But you're kind of weighing in and saying, yeah, that works for me, and it seems to work in our church.
What's interesting is that of all the songs I've sung in church, there have been more people that have come up even like years later and said, oh, I remember that time you did that song. I just love that song.
Well, you know, it is a missionary technique to take something old and make it new. That is to take something that meant one thing and invest it with new meaning, to capture it for some spiritual benefit. And this is true even in the Old Testament. You know, circumcision was practiced by the Egyptians, apparently, before the Jews did it. But God kind of captures this thing and reinvests it with a spiritual significance it did not have before. And being a missionary myself in a number of different places over the years and having been trained as a missionary, I know this is the kind of thing that you want to try to do, is to grab something like Don Richardson did with the Peace Child. Wrote a whole book on this thing called Peace Child, this thing that was part of their culture. And he used it as a hook, and he gave it new significance and used it as a springboard to communicate the gospel. And there are a lot of things like that. So I'm certainly open in principle to these kinds of things. I guess it just depends on a case-by-case basis. Maybe with this song, he was a little more sensitive than most.
Sure. I actually called the whole thing kind of my reclamation project, going out and reclaiming secular songs.
No, I had thought that Martin Luther did this, but then somebody told, like, he took old drinking songs and made them into, which he probably sang at one time or another because he was a big fan of beer, and then maybe added Christian lyrics. But then somebody told me that was apocryphal, so, I don't know. But, you know, I think The Battle Hymn of the Republic is one of those songs that went through a number of different renditions, and it had been an old drinking ditty, and then it kind of moved along. And the person who – I think what happened is, if I understand the story correctly, is the person wrote it initially for spiritual significance, the song, and the music, the not the lyrics, but the music. And then, ribald lyrics got added to it over time. And then it was then captured once again around the time of the Civil War and reinvested with this new meaning and these elegant and the soaring lyrics of the Battle Hymn of the Republic. So even in our own tradition, that kind of thing has happened, it seems.
Right. Well, Greg, I'm going to go back to decorating the tree.
All right. Give my best to your husband, Roberta. I appreciate the call.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. We'll be back in just a moment. One last break before our final segment, and we'll be talking about Barack Obama and Saddleback Church when we return on Stand to Reason.
It is a rare opportunity to study under some of the finest minds in the field of Christian thought. We have collected a world-class team of Christian thinkers to give you the tools and skills you need to confidently defend the faith and to guard the treasure that has been entrusted to you as a follower of Christ. Our 2006 Master Series of Christian Thought set of lectures includes 5 excellent Christian teachers addressing timely topics to help you understand and address timely issues confronting Christian ambassadors. You can find out more about this unique training resource at our website, str.org, or call our office at 1-800-2-REASON. Learn from some of the sharpest minds in Christianity today. You'll be challenged and encouraged. The 2006 Master Series and Christian Thought Series is available at str.org.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to his disciple Timothy and encouraging him to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul also exhorted him to guard the treasure. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman whose job it is to protect those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that has been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. Stand to Reason has chosen it as our theme this year because it reflects the heartbeat of our ministry. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we are training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at www.str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful training materials to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's www.str.org.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason. Almost hate to interrupt that music, and that was Elvis. No kidding. Elvis Presley there. Just a reminder, coming up here, of course, January 7th, January 8th, through February 5th, Monday nights from 7 to 9:30, our annual Master Series for Christian Thought, and kicking off our series on January... Now, I'm confused about this enforcer here. It says January through February 5th, and it says January 9th is J.P. Moreland, so I don't know. But it'll be that Monday, probably the second full week. Whether it's the 8th or the 9th, I'll have to double-check on that. But J.P. Moreland will be teaching that Monday on the lost virtue of happiness. And then every week following that, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris, James Emery White, Alan Schliemann at Stand to Reason. And finally, yours truly doing cleanup, our Master Series of Christian Thought. Hope you can participate. There is a cost for the 5 sessions at $30 for the whole series. If you want to go to an individual session, it's only $7. If you want to go night by night kind of thing. Seating is limited. You want to pre-register. But I think you're going to, as we have every year, you're going to have a wonderful time at our series. Okay, let's go back to the phones. And in Richmond, Virginia, David. Welcome to Stand to Reason, David.
Hi, Greg.
Hi.
I first want to say that we heard you out at the Love God With All Your Mind, and just my wife and I really enjoyed hearing you.
Oh, great. You mean just recently?
Yes. We actually met you briefly, but I'm sure you met hundreds of people.
So. Yeah, well, I did, but I'm sure if I saw you again, I would recognize you, but I wouldn't remember your, your name.
About we're talking about Barack Obama and Saddleback.
Yes.
I guess I'll just say briefly what we thought about it is, we don't think it would be a good idea because, I guess, to me, it depends on 2 criteria, I would think, that how associated you are, you know, how much association you have with the church, with the world, as well as what issue it's about. So by inviting him into the pulpit, it seems like you have a very close association.
Right.
And when he has such a strong stance on abortion, and Rick Warren was on CNN or some show at least, and he was saying, well, I agree abortion is a Holocaust, which
mm-hmm.
is as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very serious issue.
Now, I understand. Let me ask you some questions about this, David. What is your understanding of actually what took place at this AIDS conference that was held at Rick Warren's church at Saddleback here in Southern California?
Well, this is only from secondhand accounts, admittedly, but my understanding was that he was invited to speak from the pulpit at Saddleback Church. Now,
okay, yeah, and this is where I think there's been some confusion. He did not speak at Rick Warren's Sunday service from the pulpit. He spoke at Rick Warren's conference on AIDS, which probably was held in the same venue, and therefore he might have been using the same podium. But it's a very, very different thing in that case than what is characterized when you say you put him in the pulpit. That you're giving up, if you put somebody in your pulpit, you're giving up your Sunday preaching to the faithful, as it were, and you're putting someone else that you esteem in that significant role with regards to your church. And that is not what happened as far as I understand. I was there 2 weeks ago tomorrow, and I taught in a side event. And I talked to some of the people on campus about this because I think the day before I'd been taken to task for setting my foot on Rick Warren's property. And the guy there told me, he said, look, it's an AIDS conference, for goodness sake. There's all kinds of different speakers here, and Obama is one of those speakers. And the question then, and I know that Rick Warren has taken a lot of heat from evangelical leaders on this, but I wonder if they really understand exactly what it was that happened. Obama was just one of these one of the speakers, although he's obviously a kind of a headliner and well known as the senator, I think. Is it senator or congressman from Illinois?
Senator,
yeah. So he's a significant, he's a rising star in the Democratic Party, and I know this gives some people pause. Wow, gee, why are you giving this guy so much visibility? Well, it might be that he was the right man for that particular presentation. I don't know. And so, I'm pro-life. And Bernard Nathanson was one of the founders of the National Abortion Rights Action League in New York City, and probably had his hands in more abortions than any other doctor alive. But he was also an atheist. He actually became pro-life on the merits of the argument, even though his spiritual convictions didn't change at all. Now, at the time that Bernard Nathanson was an atheist pro-lifer, and I admit there's not too many of them around, and he has since become a Roman Catholic. But at the time that he was an atheist pro-lifer, would it have been inappropriate for Stand to Reason to make common cause with him on the pro-life issue, even though he was an atheist? What do you think?
I think that would be okay, just in the sense that if you're only rallying around a common cause, I think we should be able to have some associated with people that disagree or agree with.
Right. I agree entirely. In fact, to me, in the case of Bernard Nathanson, it would have been a tremendous coup to get an atheist on your side in the pro-life issue. In other words, somebody who sees this abortion as wrong on the merits without any possibility, in this case, of being convinced for religious reasons. And some people want to put it that way, reduce it to a religious argument. It's not. By the same token, if I almost said Lee Strobel. Rick Warren over at Saddleback wants to do something because he's motivated by his love for Christ about AIDS in the world. And he can make common cause with other people who want to do something about AIDS in the world, though they have different motivations and different beliefs from Rick on other issues that aren't on the table. What would be wrong with him making common cause there? I understand the impulse that people have initially, but I would like them, especially leadership in this country who are evangelicals, to think through this a little bit more. You know, I saw the LA Times a couple days ago. I think it was the LA Times. And they were making a comment about kind of how, wow, even evangelical Christians are climbing on board with this. Can you believe it? Evangelicals care about AIDS. I mean, it was almost like they were stunned. Now, of course, evangelicals have been involved with AIDS for 20 years,
right,
in some sort or another, but they never got the press. Now Rick Warren steps up and says, we want to help out. And he's making common cause with Bono, who is also a Christian. And so he's out there and he's visible. And they're saying, oh, all right. Well, it's too bad that they notice evangelical efforts only when it's a politically correct concern, AIDS, whatever. But I'm glad they noticed, because we have low Q in the culture right now. We have a low public image, and they think we're just a bunch of bad guys.
Right.
Now, yeah, I think it's a stereotype that's inaccurate, all right? But I'm glad that Rick Warren has taken up this cause that at least plays against the stereotype with the common man. And the fact that he would even invite Barack Obama to speak also plays against the stereotype, which is good public relations. And I don't see it as a compromise of morality. Unfortunately, when you have – when he does that and then a whole bunch of evangelical leaders, you know, start spitting fire at him for doing this, then what they end up doing is reinforcing the negative stereotype and undoing, in a sense, the good from a public relations perspective that – that Rick Warren has done here. Now, I'm not suggesting that he is just doing this AIDS thing for PR. I think he's doing it because he cares about people and those that are dying of AIDS in Africa. But when, but I think it also has, you know, a PR advantage here. This is a great coup for us for other reasons, given the way PR has worked in the past. And so I hate to see that undermined. Does that make sense to you?
It does. I guess my concern is that, well, one, that the PR will get played the other way, too, that now somehow that Obama will get the endorsement of evangelicals. I mean, not that – I mean, I don't know what he thinks. I can't judge the senator's mind. I mean, but just in the sense that he seems to be kind of saying, see, evangelicals agree with me.
Yeah, I don't – evangelical voters will never do that. I guarantee you they'll never do that. They are too suspicious. And I think in some ways, rightfully so. And so they are not going to say, gee, Barack must be a pretty good guy if Rick Warren will have him at his church and speak at his AIDS conference. You know, for all I know, I'm having such a hard time with names today. Who's the Andrew Sullivan, the homosexual activist? He could have been there. And if it were my AIDS conference and I was concerned about the things that Rick Warren was concerned about, I wouldn't have any trouble with having Andrew Sullivan there either. Although you can see that would be controversial, wouldn't it?
Right. Yeah, you find the basic that it wasn't speaking. Now, if he would have spoken from the pulpit, would you agree that would have been not a good choice?
Well, if he had been replacing Rick Warren on Rick Warren's Sunday service and speaking, then I think it would have been a different situation.
But the fact that essentially you're saying it's a conference about AIDS.
Exactly.
The variety of speakers, that's a distinctive that allows you to have association with people that you wouldn't. May associate for the cause of crime.
Of course, you're making common cause on a broad issue that ought to be a concern to all of us. Poor people, and this isn't homosexuals in Africa. These are kids who are born with AIDS because of sexual sin of their parents. But nevertheless, it can't be just dismissed like that. I don't think Christians in general do dismiss AIDS for that reason. But I do think that there's this connection with homosexuality in this country and. Justifiably so, but not there. And so for Rick to say, look at these poor people that are hurting. Let's work together to help these people. I think that's good and noble, and it's good PR for us, and it's smart. And I just, under those circumstances, I'm all for it. And I just think it's sad that there have been so many, apparently, religious leaders that have just stepped up to criticize him in this point. One person actually said, Obama couldn't really care about people dying with AIDS because he's pro-choice, for goodness sake.
Well, exactly. You don't know what he thinks.
Of course. Why not just take him at the man at his words? Maybe he's playing politics on everything. Who knows? Why don't we just take his actions at face value instead of questioning his motive and say, yeah, seems like he cares about people with AIDS. And maybe he is confused about the abortion issue, but I can't say he's confused on abortion, so he couldn't possibly care about anybody about anything. I mean, that's silly. And a lot of people are confused about abortion, but they still show acts of mercy and charity in other ways, don't you think?
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't know if you feel any differently about it having chatted.
Well, I was kind of telling Melinda, like, fairly ambivalent, but I guess part of it was the confusion that I could agree with you that if it was a conference, I mean, say it was a conference outside of the church facility itself, which it sounds like more was just a question.
Yeah, well, my suspicion is it was in the church facility, but to me that's irrelevant because it doesn't matter what you use the building for. Sometimes they have, you know, secular concerts and stuff. You know, churches rent their buildings out, so I'm not troubled by that itself. The venue doesn't matter so much. Anyway, it was a good conversation, David. I appreciate your thoughts, and I hope it was helpful to some of those who have heard about this. It's some bad information going on, I think, and people having knee-jerk reactions, which sometimes we're guilty of. That's it for today, friends. I'll see you next week, same time, same station. In the meantime, how about that for original statement, right? Go out and give them heaven this week, okay, friends? Bye-bye now.